Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Global Challenges and the Future of U.S. Diplomacy. With me to discuss some of the challenges the United States faces today and what role diplomacy can play in resolving them is Ambassador Frank Wisner. Ambassador Wisner is currently an international affairs advisor at the law firm of Squire Patton Boggs. He spent four decades as a foreign service officer and served as U.S. ambassador to India, Egypt, the Philippines, and Zambia. He also served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and Undersecretary of State for National Security Affairs, a very distinguished career. Ambassador, thanks for joining me.
Jim, it's a pleasure to be with you. And as a many-decade member of the Council on Foreign Relations, it's an honor to be participating in one of its very distinguished programs.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I now know why you're a diplomat. And I actually want to sort of pick your brain because you've had a lot of experience with a range of foreign policy issues. And I want to begin with one place where you served. That was ambassador to India. Obviously, news the last several weeks has been this clash between India and China along the so-called line of actual control. Can you sort of give us a sense of what's at stake in this clash? Is this a small dust-up or something that has bigger potential ramifications?
Well, it is a very long-standing problem. It actually goes right back to the days of the old British Raj. Neither the British nor the Chinese on their side ever defined a border between the northern reaches of British-dominated India and the western reaches of China. So when the communist government took over in China in the late 1940s, it came upon a problem and it became worse with the occupation of Tibet. The differences between the two over the location of the border exploded into a border war in the early 1960s, in which China was extremely successful militarily, defeated the Indians. And since that time, while the Indians and the Chinese have sat uneasily across the border and occasionally have negotiated, they've never been able to define a quote-unquote border. And as a result, from time to time, their military forces that are situated in the High Himalayas come into contact with one another. And as the case of the other day, when 20-some Indian soldiers were killed, occasionally it's bloody. But there's another history that parallels it, and that is that India and China have avoided another major war. The Prime Minister and Xi Jinping have met a dozen times since Modi took office, and I suspect that that's the path of the future. Neither of them want a war. Both of them want to avoid a confrontation, but both of them are determined to make a stand on what they believe are their appropriate sides of this border area. Both of them have been building roads and advancing their defense positions closer and closer to one another, which has led to some of the difficulties we now face.
Now, I noticed the Trump administration offered to mediate or provide good offices. I don't get a sense that either Beijing or New Delhi has been interested in taking up the administration on that offer. Why is that?
Yes, you're absolutely right, Jim. They both believe that they can manage this crisis bilaterally without aggravating it by bringing in a third party. And while the Indians have welcomed the sense that they have strong backing from the United States, they don't want us sitting at the table. They can handle it in their judgment. But that doesn't mean they are going to leave the latest problem unaddressed. They will talk to the Chinese and are talking to them, but they're beginning to take measures that show they have leverage, and they have leverage. They have some commercial leverage. They, in fact, blocked the use of Chinese apps, which are very, very commonly used, widespread use in India. I suspect they will be blocking other forms of Chinese technology. They'll be reviewing Chinese investments in India that have become very large. China's put a lot at stake in the Indian market. So they have that, but I think they also have political leverage. This is not a time in which China needs yet another enemy. China's got quarrels with the Japanese in the South China Sea, in the Malay Coast, Hong Kong, the United States. China, it may not want yet another major quarrel with a very big country. And while India is weaker than China in all generally measurable attributes, nonetheless, India has a huge international reputation. And it's one I think the Chinese will be cautious about pushing too far.
Frank, I want to get to the issue of China's relations with its neighbors. But first, I want to sort of drill down a little bit about the U.S.-India relationship, because there has been, as you know, for a number of years, talk about how the United States and India sort of could form a natural partnership. They're both democratic countries, and there's some incentive for them to work together. I think some of that talk about a U.S.-India strategic relationship or partnership has been spurred by recent events. Do you see the United States and India signing up in some sort of formal level of cooperation in countering China?
I do not. I believe the Indians attach much too much importance to maintaining their own strategic autonomy. They are not an ally of the United States. They don't want to be. They sometimes look at us and recognize those who are our allies are kind of uncomfortable with being an ally. And they certainly don't want to be seen in their own domestic circumstance or internationally as our cat's paw. And they don't fully trust us. So it's a more an accommodation of interests. And those interests have substantially come together over the last three decades. And since the end of the Cold War, we and India have converged. They like that convergence, but they don't want it to be one of dominant partner, junior partner. I think we also have to be careful that we don't look at the Indians as an ally and overexpect them to deliver. There are differences. We have clear differences with them. We have differences, for example, in their very important relationship with Russia. Russia is a major arms supplier. Russia, in their minds, is another feature in maintaining the balance of power in Asia. They want to keep their ties to Russia strong and open and vibrant. It cuts a bit against the grain with us. And then we have the Pakistan problem. It hasn't gone away. It isn't going to go away. We have different approaches to Pakistan. Now we have growing differences between ourselves and New Delhi. Over trade. We have a number of sanctions that have been placed on Indian industries. We have failed to achieve a breakthrough on a series of rather minor trade differences, and we're talking about a big 301 investigation of digital taxation. And finally, I think the differences are beginning to be a bit accentuated or are rising, where the Indian-American relationship has been bipartisan. There is growing concern in this country about the Hindutva phenomena in Indian politics, the increasing Hindu nationalist dominance in Indian domestic politics, the difficulties the Indian press, Indian Muslims have had, Indian actions in taking over and abolishing the erstwhile state of Jammu and Kashmir. All of these have played, and for the first time in literally several decades, I've seen criticism of India in the Congress, and it's real. India was always a dream for Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King. Hindutva has no universal appeal. And the fact that it is so politically charged in Indian terms is scratching on our relationship. So for all of these reasons, we are going to be not partners, but we're going to have converging interests. And both of us recognize those interests, particularly in managing the rise of China, are really critically important.
Well, let's talk a bit about China, Frank, and how the United States should respond. Clearly, China has emerged as a major power, if you want, you can call it a superpower. How do you suspect or how do you think the United States should deal with the challenge posed by China?
Jim, I think that's the single most important question in American foreign policy today, apart from global issues like climate change. But in terms of sorting out the world that we're living in which great powers are reasserting their presence on the world stage, our relationship with China is just absolutely at the center. And if we manage it badly, there are huge costs to be paid. There are also a lot of illusions, certainly on our side, that somehow China can be pushed back into a corner. China is much too big to be contained or pushed around. We've got to learn to manage a relationship with China, not dream that one day we can sort it out to our own unilateral advantage. It won't happen. My own view is that China is going to be a very difficult partner. And until we in China, as we in Russia did over time during the Cold War, learn to live with one another, find ways in which to avoid each other's most important red lines, there will be friction. But I think the right way, Jim, to approach China is to think in three terms. First of all, you confront China when China overreaches. You confront China if she's asserting her definition of rights in the South China Sea and impeding the flow of international traffic or impinging on the territorial rights of other Southeast Asian nations or threatening Japan along the Senkakus. In those sorts of areas where China is threatening, we must confront and push back hard, preferably in alliance with other Asians and with our global European allies. Push back, insist on China respecting core international standards and rules of behavior. If it means standing by India, we ought to stand by India. Second, if confront when China is pressing is one step, the second step is compete. And compete we can and should and must. We need to compete globally. In the field of global infrastructure, there's no reason China be the only nation building ports and harbors and rail and internet connectivity from Beijing to Rotterdam. The world has a hunger for infrastructure. Certainly between ourselves, our European allies, the international financial institutions, and our private sectors, we can mobilize capital to compete with China. We can compete with China in AI, artificial intelligence. There isn't any area of scientific expertise we can't compete, either alone or in combination with European allies who share our concerns about China. Japan shares our concerns about China. Korea. Finally, the third element is to cooperate, because there are areas of life with China in which we and China need to work together. Global climate change, North Korea, pandemics. These are no-can-go-alone areas of operations where we and China can work together. So I bring it down to three C's. Confront, where you have to, compete all the time, and cooperate where opportunities come before you.
Well, Frank, I appreciate your boiling it down into a short, pithy statement to make it easy to remember. I want to actually sort of just focus on one aspect of that, and it was your mention of working with our friends and allies in the region. And again, as I noted at the beginning of our conversation, you served as U.S. ambassador to the Philippines, so you have some on-the-ground knowledge of how regional countries view the United States. What do our friends and allies in East Asia, Southeast Asia, want from the United States right now, because they live very close to China? They have important economic relations with China. To some extent, they're sort of on the edge of a black hole of the great gravitational pull of the Chinese economy. So what do the Philippines, the Thailands, the Japans, the South Koreas want from the United States?
Let me start with two quick and important points. The first thing they want from us is predictability. They want to have a sense that whatever Washington believes in, states as its policies, we're going to stick by. And if we are going to maintain our patterns of friendship, then we really are going to do that. We're not going to nickel and dime the Japanese and South Koreans over troop support costs. We'll find a fair bargain. We're not going to second guess any nation in Asia with which we have ties about our own relationships with them. We don't take unilateral actions with North Korea without proper consultations with Japan and South Korea, as an example. They want predictability, stable, predictable American policy. Second, they want to make certain we have their back, but they want strategic autonomy, their ability to protect their own interests and deal with China. They want to trade with China. They want to find areas of political cooperation with China, but they want to have the sense that we will stand behind them and make certain that China cannot threaten them, that China's habits of bullying and dominance don't overwhelm them. So they want us at their back and at their side, but not in front of them. And they are keen to see both of these happen, for they recognize that China's approach to the region is hierarchical. that as the ancients of China saw the region, the emperor at the central kingdom is at the top of the pecking order, and everyone else owes a degree of fealty and obeisance. They do not expect to look at Beijing in a subordinate position, and to help maintain that balance, they need strong, predictable, confident ties with the United States. They don't need to see us enter into major trading arrangements and then pull out of them in less than one electoral cycle.
So you're referring to the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Trans-Pacific Partnership, a major strategic blunder on the part of the United States.
We could obviously talk a lot longer about China and East Asia, but I want to skip a region. I want to talk about the Middle East. You served for a number of years as U.S. ambassador to Egypt. Sort of as you look at the Middle East today, it's a bit different than it was when you were based in Cairo. How do you make sense of the region, where it's going, and what U.S. interests are?
Well, those are two quite different questions. First of all, how do I see U.S. interests in the region? And that's the starting point. We actually have long-standing and, I believe, permanent interests in the stability and in the security of the Middle Eastern region. It's not only our desire to see Israel's independence maintained. By the way, I think the Israelis are largely able to do that themselves today. They've developed significantly as a military and economic force. We have an interest in the stability of the Middle East as a hydrocarbons producer. Not that we will be the importer, but we will very definitely have an interest in the global hydrocarbons market. If the hydrocarbons market is disrupted, the whole global economy is undercut, and our interests in global economic stability are compromised. Third, I think we have an interest in not seeing any other power dominant in the Middle East and thereby threatening friends, allies of ours in the region, or using the region to export trouble outside. We know what export's like. We've lived from 9/11 with Islamic terror. The region has capabilities of being extremely troublesome. So you can't leave the Middle East. We have interests, and those will be enduring. And I don't care what administration is in office, there's no way of packing up your kit bag and saying we got lots of shale oil and gas, and we can come home and forget about the Middle East. It simply isn't going to happen. We'll be dragged back into it. So that's why we're there. Now, what are we faced with? And here the story, Jim, in my judgment, is not good at all. Instead of the Arab Spring producing a new wave of regeneration of the region and democratic rule and governments, except we have seen since the beginning of the Arab Spring in 2010-11, we've seen chaos. And I'm afraid this year, 2020-2021, we'll see an accentuation, certainly a continuation of the chaos that we've known over the last decade. Just think about it, and you can go through the list very quickly. Yemen, the civil war isn't going to come to an end. We in Iran are going to be in a highly competitive position, and the Gulf states in Iran are going to be living on tenterhooks. Iraq is extremely fragile. Syria, the civil war is not over, and there are direct differences between Israel and Iran over Syria. There are differences with the Turks over Syria. There are differences inside of Syria between its own unresolved civil war factions. Syria is going to continue to be a mess. Lebanon, which has been such a haven of friendship for the United States, our great university there, AUB. More graduates from AUB signed the UN convention in San Francisco than any other university in the world.
Did not know that.
A great center of American influence throughout the region and over the decades. Lebanon is now in utter chaos, economic and political, and extremely dangerous. Head now south to Libya. The civil war shows no signs of abating. If anything, you're seeing the Egyptians and the Turks coming very close to serious trouble. Sudan, highly fragile. Egypt, Ethiopia along the Nile, another set of irksome issues, Turkish claims in the Eastern Mediterranean to continental shelf rights. Unfortunately, the Middle East, as Jim, I see it today, is a real problem. So then the question is, what do you do about it? If you have interests and you've got to be there and you're faced with chaos, then you have to adopt some relatively sane and stable policies. And that will be a challenge for whatever administration we see in this country after November.
Do you have any advice to offer on that score?
I have some broad thoughts, Jim. I think you have to start with the fact that chaos is your real enemy. Stability is something closer to your friend. And where you can engender conditions of stability or work for them, that's where American policy ought to be. We ought to be part of trying to get the UN mission in Yemen to have some effect in bringing the Houthi crisis with the Saudis and the Emiratis to a resolution. We have an interest in Syria, in seeing that crisis calm down, of being part of a political solution there, aiming at restabilizing Syria, of trying to find ways of helping a government like Sudan get its feet under it, using our influence to create stable conditions under which wars and civil wars can be brought to an end and where economics can begin to play their proper role and give hope to a despairing generation of young Arabs and other peoples inside the region. So, stability. Second, I think the old rules of the balance of power. We have to start with the idea that this region is a region of sovereign states, and those sovereign states' borders matter. They've got to be protected. The absence of the respect for sovereignty is chaos. So working to achieve balance with ourselves, the Russians, outsiders or insiders like Iran and Turkey become really important. Finally, I would say if I had one area where American policy has fundamentally got to change, and that is the way we look at and deal with Iran. You cannot achieve stability in the Middle East. You cannot achieve the sovereignty of states in the Middle East without coming to some understandings with Iran. You can't foreclose the danger of nuclear proliferation without an understanding with Iran. And so a political approach to Iran as opposed to this administration's, in my judgment, failed policy of confrontation with Iran is one area where we've really got to take a second look at how we're proceeding.
Frank, you know, as we talk about all of these challenges, in many conversations, people tend to think in terms of the use of military force and how military force can solve things. But I think my takeaway hearing from you is really what we need is more diplomacy. And I guess I'd like to maybe draw you out a little bit on sort of how you see the role of diplomacy and of diplomat in American foreign policy.
First of all, let me associate myself 100% with your opening statement that military force is not the best way to proceed. I mean, if we look back today at the use of military force and what it accomplished, we have to recognize that either we're still stuck with problems like Korea with forces deployed coming now 70 years later, or there's no end. The military solution does not produce a conclusion. Our problem in Korea, for example, is our failure to recognize that we have to deal with a North Korea, not just a nuclear problem. And the military solution isn't going to change it. In the Middle East, it's really true. Military solutions have been totally elusive, deeply costly in blood and treasure in Iraq and Afghanistan. We've learned not only did we fail to accomplish our objectives militarily, we did two other things. We actually weakened the perception of American power, and at the same time, we weakened our own domestic support for a responsible set of policies in the Middle East. Our population can look at Washington and say, what'd you get us into? A lot of dead Americans and a huge sum of money spent to no useful purpose. So let me again underscore the outcome in the way to proceed is an understanding there's no end to problems. It's how you deal with them. And you deal with problems principally politically. In fact, military means politics by another extension. And political aims are achieved largely through diplomacy. That doesn't mean you don't need a strong military to back you up and a capable intelligence service, but you have to have clearly defined political priorities and strategies to pursue them. And those strategies must be based on realistic goals And based on the appropriate number of resources over a period of time, that will permit you to achieve your strategy. So politics, policy are at the center, and diplomacy is how you get there.
Frank, I know you've heard a number of senior U.S. military officers talk about the importance of diplomacy to their success. Former Secretary of Defense James Mattis famously said that if you aren't willing to fund diplomacy, be prepared to buy me more bullets. So I want to ask you, sort of as you look at the State Department today, if you could make a pitch to the powers to be, what would you want them to do for the State Department and the Foreign Service? What is it that a sort of modern State Department, a more fully funded State Department would look like? What would be the top of your list?
Well, I'm going to start not necessarily directly with the State Department, but with the way decisions are made about national security and foreign policy in Washington. Today, we have no process and policy formulation disorder and chaos. Washington ends up with reasonably successful shot at good policies if there is orderly deliberation between participating agencies, the State Department, CIA, Commerce, so on, Treasury, and the NSC pulling these together and giving the president choices and then turning back to the agencies and asking them within their mandates and writs to execute those policies. We don't have that today. And in the absence, we have a severely dysfunctional government. You can have a great State Department, but if it doesn't participate in an orderly policy process, it's not going to be of much use to you. So I start with a process of making decisions. And I go back to the late 1940s. The whole elaboration of the national security system in our government is what we have to re-envisage and re-energize and make effective once again. Inside of that, state has an incredibly important role. And the Foreign Service, a relatively small federal service inside the State Department. The Foreign Service are your eyes and ears, your communications, your points of advocacy around the world in virtually every independent country going, with one or two exceptions. We don't have anybody in Iran or in North Korea, but we are present everywhere in the world. And together with our intelligence services, the Foreign Service provides a flow of insights, analysis, understandings of how America can deal with other governments in a world in which sovereign states are reasserting primacy. And in this period ahead of us, we have to learn to live with sovereign states. So you need people with language skills, professional skills on the ground to help you understand how to shape your policies to deal. And that's where the State Department really comes in and can do its job. If it's properly resourced, if it's properly led, and then if it contributes to a structure of national security and foreign policy decision making.
Frank, we're coming to the end of our time, and I want to, if I may, sort of draw on your broader advice. I suspect there are more than a few people listening to this podcast who have an interest in joining the Foreign Service. Perhaps they even are junior Foreign Service officers. What sort of advice would you give people who are interested in the Foreign Service or just starting out there?
I think I can start out, Jim, and probably share this with you, and that is that public service is a very high calling. It's very attractive, very rewarding. Being of service to others is enormously satisfying. Being able to represent the United States abroad in a world of difficulty, chaos, and challenge, to be responsible for the representation of the United States is just a terrific life. When I left the State Department, I looked back at my colleagues and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have one thing to tell you. I didn't spend a day in this profession that I wouldn't go back and live again." You live on the edge of learning, understanding, insight, participation, and finally service. And it's an enormously exciting career. I recommend it highly to a young man or woman who feels that that's where they want to be abroad, want to be able to represent their country. You won't get rich, but you will have the most fascinating, committed, engaged life, not only for yourself, but your families.
On that uplifting note, I'm going to close the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Ambassador Frank Wisner. He is an international affairs advisor to law firm Squire Patton Boggs. Frank, thank you very much for your service, and thank you very much for sharing your advice today. It was a real pleasure.
Jim, it's been my pleasure to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.